Have you ever woken up with a feeling you couldn't shake? That morning, I knew something was wrong. My husband, Peter, and my mother were both fighting cancer, both supposedly improving, yet dread wrapped around me like a shroud. Hours later, at Memorial Sloan Kettering, my fears crystallized into devastating reality. Peter's tumors were growing aggressively. "I'm not going to make it," he said, handing me a handwritten list. At the top, "Cancel the divorce." Our storybook romance had fractured through tragedy and misunderstanding. But now we faced something far more immediate than our marital problems. We were running out of time. This is the story of what happens when life stops being theoretical and becomes urgently, painfully real. It's about learning to love fiercely when tomorrow isn't guaranteed, about finding strength in the rubble of loss, and discovering that sometimes the universe teaches us its most important lessons through the people we lose. He was rude, wearing a ridiculous gold chain that screamed 1980s hip-hop wannabe. When this tall white guy with reddish blonde hair heckled me in our workplace cafeteria, I dismissed him immediately. Days later, Peter cut the line to buy me the same meticulously ordered breakfast sandwich as an apology. When he asked me to dinner, I challenged him, "Read Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon first." Weeks later, he appeared at my desk with genuine insights into the African-American experience that made me fall in love. For my birthday, this man who'd never painted before created his interpretation of the novel, the most thoughtful gift I'd ever received. We decided then we would marry, but loving across racial lines meant navigating constant hostility. Black man on the street would call out, "Hey queen, are you confused?" A stranger on a subway platform grabbed my arm, trying to physically pull me away from Peter. A kind Ghanaian doorman pulled me aside. These people are not our people. All these voices created a chorus of doubt. What was the universe trying to tell us? I was the first daughter to a man desperately wanting a son. In our matrilineal Ghanaian culture, boys were still prized. When Lieutenant Jerry Rawlings overthrew Ghana's government in 1982, my detained father found faith through a Bible in prison. After reuniting with my pregnant mother, both converted to Christianity. When my sister Abba arrived, Dad broke tradition by naming her after my mother, then focused on raising strong daughters, with me as the standard bearer. I spent my teenage years in Colorado, acutely aware of being both Black and African. Teachers mangled my name. At home, I was cocooned in Ghanaian culture, speaking Fanti and eating fufu rather than pizza. Despite being cheerleading captain and running track, I never got elected to student council or homecoming court. No one asked me to prom. Yet at 14, looking in the mirror at my almond eyes, coffee skin, and coiled hair, I thought, "You are so damn dope." I'd simply been dropped in the wrong place. Then at 17, I discovered a lump in my breast. For a month before my biopsy, I lived in constant fear. Though benign, this brush with mortality changed everything. Death had revealed itself as a constant presence. The Prozac I took daily became armor against emotional lows, but it dulled my capacity for joy. I existed in emotional purgatory where nothing could hurt me, but I couldn't feel the good stuff either. That homemade lasagna became our covenant, not save for special occasions. Peter would smell it from the elevator, exclaiming, "I know you're cooking something good." But real life crept in. Peter rose with dawn while I slept in. His Catholic faith troubled me with its stance on homosexuality. Most critically, our ambitions diverged. Peter moved cautiously between jobs while I craved constant challenge. When Spike Lee offered me a position overseeing Pepsi's campaign, Peter questioned it despite my excitement. Though it meant a pay cut from my miserable recruiting job, he insisted I stay for stability. I'd watched my mother defer to my father's decisions. I quit within days. After 4 years of marriage, Peter wanted children, while I remained uncertain. In March 2008, despite birth control, I became pregnant. I spent days crying privately while Peter celebrated. At 6 months, tests showed severe preeclampsia. I wouldn't survive another month. Peter faced an impossible choice: save me or the baby. Though I chose our baby, Peter chose me. My daughter Eve arrived with one push, tiny and perfect with golden hair. In the silence, I held her briefly before she was gone. Days later, my milk came in, a cruel reminder my body didn't know my baby was gone. We cremated Eve in a pale green heart-shaped urn. I returned to work 3 weeks later, desperate for normalcy, only to break down when a colleague asked for baby pictures. Against warnings, I obsessed over getting pregnant immediately. When I conceived, I left the positive test on Peter's pillow on our anniversary. I was overjoyed. He was terrified. This pregnancy meant a new doctor, obsessive monitoring, and daily blood thinner injections for preeclampsia diagnosed at 8 weeks. I refused a baby shower and wouldn't set up a nursery. At 31 weeks, my blood pressure spiked. On May 28th, Lyell was born 2 months early, tiny enough to fit in my palm, but with a powerful cry. Her Hebrew name meant belonging to God, both prayer and warning. The NICU became my second home during 18-hour daily visits, creating another fault line with Peter. One night at our favorite Indian restaurant, I finally said it. I don't think I want to be married anymore. I was no longer the person Peter met. I wanted Lyell to know the bold, fearless version of me. In early 2013, Lyman's shoes at Peter's apartment revealed he'd met Angela. My jealousy shifted to focusing on his happiness until a neck growth exposed devastating news, Burkitt's lymphoma. My life became an exhausting marathon of mom's chemo, Peter's care, work, and Lyell. Angela and I became unlikely allies, trading hospital shifts. When Peter achieved remission, we celebrated and agreed to divorce, but lawyers made everything adversarial until the call came. Peter's cancer was terminal. Our petty grievances evaporated. I asked Peter to end things with Angela. I couldn't share our remaining time. During morning prayers, God's answer thundered through me. You didn't appreciate them. I hadn't truly valued Ben, Eve, or Peter until losing them. Peter insisted on a final fishing trip with Lyell and proposed again at a Manhattan overlook, demanding I say yes despite our marriage. His decline accelerated. Lymphoma attacked his nervous system mercilessly. One night, he voiced his deepest fear. What if I get trapped inside and you don't know I'm still here? I promised never to leave. We didn't tell Lyell until after her Christmas pageant. When she asked, "Where's Daddy?" I simply said, "He's gone." Her quiet, "Okay," shattered my heart. The next morning, Peter's pill caddy shattered. A spiritual sign, like our wedding song playing after his death. Peter had promised, "I'll go to heaven and take care of Eve, while you stay here and take care of Lyell." His niece later called about a dream where Uncle Peter held a little girl behind a tree, Eve, whom our families never discussed. 200 people filled the sanctuary for Peter's memorial on his 44th birthday, despite a snowstorm. I placed his ashes beside Eve's heart-shaped urn. Turning 44 terrified me. I'd seen 444 everywhere since his death and tattooed it on my wrist. When the day arrived, I felt peaceful acceptance. Loss taught me profound lessons, from Ben to defy boundaries, from Eve that love grows in absence, from Peter to live with intentional urgency. We plan for futures that may never arrive while forgetting to live urgently now. Life demands we show up fully with all our messy, imperfect love. Make the lasagna on Tuesday. Say I love you when it feels awkward. The urgent life isn't reckless. It's intentional, as if every moment matters. Because it does.